Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We've had a difficult 24 hours in this country, and we'll keep you up to date on events as they unfold. But, you know, we also think it's important to keep moving ahead with our lives and continue sharing advice that helps make them a little better every day. And we feel really fortunate to have you listening in. We're talking about your vehicle on the show today, and I want you to know that you should be sure to stay with us on the air or online for continued coverage of the news of the day. But we're going to talk vehicles and vehicle maintenance now with Jim Ward. He's been with us for a number of years, and sadly for us, but happily for him, he has just retired. Jim Ward, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to have you here. We're also welcoming for the first time Jack Schaefer. He's the service and parts director at Smart Motors. And Jake, thanks for joining us. Oh, we lost Jake for a minute. We'll get him back. What questions do you have about your car battery, for example? Are you having problems with your vehicle? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, Jim, let's talk about your retirement here for a minute. What are your retirement plans?
Well, you know, in the short term, we're in the midst of a house remodel that we've been working on most of 2020. Obviously, you're going to have a lot more time to put into it now, but, we want to get some of our projects wrapped up. And, ultimately, 2020, I think, probably changed a lot of people's plan. The beginning of this year, I wouldn't have told you this is what I was planning to do. But I think, it's been quite a year for reexamining everything in life. And so Sue and I, my wife and I, came to the conclusion that this was the time for us and to get these projects done. And, you know, our hope has been that when we did this, we would ultimately sell the house, buy a motorhome, and I would like her to have some Arizona sun on her face in the winter times. So that's more of a, you know, the long-term goal once we get this done and sell the house. But that's our plan. And otherwise, just enjoying our time together.
Well, that sounds wonderful to me, and I really want to thank you for coming back and being with us this one last time. Jake, Jake's back with us. Tell us about your background in vehicle maintenance.
Yeah, so I started my time with automotive before my military history, actually, a little bit growing up on the farm working on John Deere's and, local implements and things like that. Started really getting into it. I was a Caterpillar C6 diesel technician in the military of the Oshkosh trucks that are built right up the road from Madison here in Oshkosh. So did that for a little while, came home, jumped in doing some franchise work and doing some independent repair facility work. And then I got in with a couple manufacturers and ultimately ended up here at Toyota.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's great to have you with us as well as we talk with our guests today. And again, I'll remind you, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jim, let's talk car batteries for a minute. You know, they often become discharged in the winter. And somebody was asking me what causes it. And I thought, well, rather than me try to answer, I'd ask you what causes it.
Well, sure. The battery just is kind of like a piggy bank in a sense that, you know, when you drive the car and the charging system is charging that battery, you're making deposits, and when you try to start the car or drive it short distances, you make withdrawals from it. But temperature is another huge factor, and that's why batteries are more prone to discharge in cold weather. At 80 degrees, a battery is typically going to have 100% of its capacity to be able to provide starting power for the car. But you get down to 32 degrees, that hits about 65%. You get down to zero, you got about 40%. You get down somewhere near 20 below, and you've got like 25% of the original amount of power, total power that battery had to try to start the car. And at the same time, the car, the oil's colder, everything is more sluggish, and it takes more energy. So by the time you get down to about zero, your battery's got about 60% less power, and the engine needs about 210% more power to start. And so, you know, if a lot of people are in situations now where they're not driving that car every day, they're not working every day, and so the battery just slowly becomes more and more discharged, and you get a cold enough day, and that may just be enough to do it. You know, there are certainly vehicle malfunctions or mistakes that can be made in leaving a light on, leaving a door ajar, a dome light on, or something that can cause a battery to discharge at a more advanced rate. But yep, it's typically, you know, related to how much is driven in the health and the state of that battery. As batteries get older, that total capacity gets less and less over time as well.
Yeah. Jake, I know a lot of people know, or even at least think they know, how to jumpstart a regular vehicle. What do we need to know about a hybrid vehicle?
Well, hybrid battery and hybrid vehicles aren't too terribly different. There is some significance as far as where the jumping posts are. You know, typically on a hybrid vehicle, in a traditional vehicle, we're used to hooking right up to the battery, starting with, you know, the dead battery positive side, and then going to the good car positive, and so on and so forth. The hybrid, we're really looking for, and I think we've seen quite a few of it this year for sure. You know, around the fuse panel underneath the hood, for ones that are outside the cabin, there's typically a positive jump post. We want to be jumping off of that for the positive side. It's going to have a little plus sign, or it's going to be red. We're not necessarily on hybrids jumping right to the battery, and we're going to be wanting to follow the same protocols when it comes to jumping, where, you know, we start with the bad battery on the positive, then we hook it up to the good car on the positive, and then we go back to the negative side of the good car, hook it up, and then ultimately hook back up to the car being jumped and fire away from there. So not a whole lot of difference, but we want to make sure on hybrid vehicles, if it has designated jump posts, that we're hooking up to those, because those are installed for the safety of the vehicle and the consumer in general.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Jim, you know, you and I talked last summer, I think it was, and I told the story of my battery going in my car, and I think it was 9 years old, the battery itself, which I believe is a pretty long time. How does a battery, how long does one typical last these days?
Yep, 9 years is great, but typically about 5 years is it. It's a little counterintuitive. If you look at a chart of our country, you'll find that battery life is shortest down hottest part of the country, down in the lower part of Texas. And so heat really over time has a more detrimental effect on batteries. And down in that part of the country, 2 to 3 years is not uncommon. In our part of the country, 5 years is about average. So there's a little bit of variance by temperature. 9 years is great. Yeah, you know, we do see exceptions to that. There's a bell-shaped curve for everything. Some fail early, some last 11 years. But, yeah, if you've got a battery that's much over 5 years in Wisconsin, it's on borrowed time.
What should you look for when you buy a new battery?
Well, the battery should be rated correctly for the car. Batteries are rated by cold cranking amps, which really is just a rating of what it comes down to is how many amps a 12-volt battery can deliver at 0 degrees for 30 seconds without dropping below 7.2 volts. Now, the bigger the engine, the more displacement usually means the larger a battery it's going to have. And so you want to basically look at what the recommendation is. Every manufacturer has a specific recommended cold cranking amp battery for their car. It doesn't hurt to go a little bit larger, but you know, you want to have something that is also not so large that your charging system's not designed to handle it either. So,
yeah, it makes good sense. Well, lots of callers online with a whole variety of questions here as I look at my call screen list. Carl in Hayward is up first. Carl, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, I got a question on car warm-up in the morning or afternoon, whatever. Is it, what are the pros and cons of warming up a car? And I was told one time that it stresses your catalytic converter if you sit there and let it just idle, excuse me, for a long period of time. And then the other thing that goes with it is synthetic oil. If I use synthetic oil, do I have to warm my car up so I don't get sludge in it from, you know, the condensation?
Good questions.
Most modern cars are designed to be warmed up while they're driven. Now, you know, within reason, if it's 40 below, any car is going to be challenged to start. And you know, if it does start, then it may run a little bit rough. So it certainly is never going to hurt to let a car idle and warm up for 30 seconds to a minute. Staying in the house and letting the car run 5 to 10 minutes, you know, one time certainly not going to hurt the car, but there are a number of considerations. You know, Carl mentioned synthetic oil. Fuel types and fuel systems make a big difference, too. One of the more efficient, more popular fuel injection systems are direct injection systems. It's a much higher pressure, and in cold weather, one of the concerns you're going to have with that kind of a fuel system is fuel dilution. You're going to, when the engine starts cold, it's running very rich, some fuel goes by the piston rings and by the pistons and gets into the oil. So there is some oil dilution. It's going to be worse with some modern engines if they're left to sit and warm up like that. So, you know, again, the engineers who design the cars, most modern cars design them to be started up and, you know, driven just about immediately.
Ah, there we go, Carl. Thank you. Michelle in Coon Valley, it's your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I have a 2016 Subaru Impreza. And the problem that I've been having, and it doesn't happen all the time, but when I go to turn the car off, the engine goes off, and to get the key out of the rest of the way, it's like it sticks and it won't come out. The engine is off. So what I found is if I start it up and I turn the wheel and put it back in park and press in hard, then it'll come out. So I was wondering what type of problem that might be.
Jake, maybe I'll turn to you for an answer.
Yeah, Michelle. So what it sounds like, I'm glad you made the comment about restarting the car and then kind of playing with the steering wheel. And most importantly, in your comment there, moving the shifter around too. So what your car has, being a modern vehicle, is it takes a lot of inputs. And when your car, you know, due to the safety features on it, wants to release that key, some of the key information it's looking for is, we call it a park neutral switch. Some people refer to it as a Prindle switch. When you're moving that car from drive into park, what the car is looking for is to see that car is in park. It is safe to take the key out and exit the vehicle. There is a small chance that maybe, you know, the computers in the car are not getting that input from the Prindle switch or that park neutral switch, that you're putting it in park, letting the safety features know the vehicle is ready to go and the key can be taken out. So, you know, you've got some good information if you wanted to get it checked out by somebody. I think you're onto something there for sure.
All right. Michelle, thank you so much for calling. Great to have with us today Jim Ward and Jake Schaefer, vehicle technicians with Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your vehicle today with our two guests, Jim Ward and Jake Schaefer of Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today as we talk vehicle maintenance with you. Lots of callers online, so I think we should go right back to the phones. Let's talk to Kathy in Oconomowoc next. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi, this is Kathy. I have a 17 Ford Flex. And probably the last 5 months, when I go to start the car, it pops up, no key detected. And I have my keys. They're all, you know, they're always in the car and stuff because I park in a garage. And, you know, I kind of wiggle the wheel. I kind of jiggle the shifter, put my seatbelt on, jiggle the keys. And after maybe 6 or 8 attempts, it'll finally turn on, and it's a button thing that you push, and just was wondering, you know, I haven't taken it in or anything, kind of just hoping it would go away, but I haven't yet. So.
Kathy, did you say that you leave it in the car all the time, the keys?
I leave the keys in the car all the time, yeah.
Okay. Jim, what about it?
Yeah, and that can be a problem. So there's a battery in that key or that key fob, and ultimately they recommend that you not keep that within about 3 meters of the car because it communicates with the car and it's keeping it awake all the time essentially and can drain that battery. There's a test they can do to see if the battery is good, but I'm going to bet that battery is getting discharged and weak, and that's why that's happening. And so getting a new battery and then storing it somewhere further away from the car is, you're most likely going to resolve that for you.
All right. So maybe keep the keys in the house, Kathy. Thank you so much. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's turn to Ian in Madison next. Hi, Ian. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi there. Thanks. So as someone who, you know, has owned a car for a while and haven't had a lot of problems, you know, I know that there's going to be a time where I'm going to need to go to a car shop to maybe get some repairs over the course of the next few years. But if someone without a lot of knowledge about vehicles, I'm a little worried about getting, say, ripped off when people recommend, say, certain things for my vehicle, and I don't really have the knowledge for that. What can I do to sort of be knowledgeable about that? So when I go to an auto shop, I'm kind of equipped with the right information, including things like price and what might actually be appropriate for my vehicle.
Oh, good question. Jim, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's just like any other service or product that you're going to buy. There's nothing like reviews to look at. You can look at reviews online of businesses, and you can talk to friends and family. I mean, it wherever you're going to have any kind of product you own, serviced, or maintained, what you want is to have a rapport with the people that you're working with there. And by talking with friends and family, you can find out, you know, who works with someone that they're comfortable with, that listens to them and gives more of that consultative relationship and not just trying to sell them something, which is something, you know, we all want to avoid just being sold. We'd rather have a relationship and someone really give us a balanced idea of what we really have to do right now, what we can put off, what's important. But, yep, you know, the experiences of friends and family and social media reviews are some of the best tools you can use.
Yeah, there you go, Ian. Thank you. Brenda in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Brenda.
I also own a 2016 Subaru and had the same problem with the key. And what I found out is it's a defect in that Subaru. And you need to take it into the dealer, and they fixed it for us for free. So it's not going to get better. You better just take it in.
All right. Good information to have there, Brenda. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Brandon,
yep,
appreciate it. Brandon in Minocqua emailed to ask how he should store his boat battery in winter. Are they okay indoors or in the garage, or should they be fully charged upon storage? What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, boat battery, you know, especially over the wintertime, if you have the capabilities to keep it in somewhere that's relatively heated. You know, Jim gave a really good temperature earlier, that 80-degree mark, you know, really unleashing full capacity of a battery. If you don't have that opportunity, a good idea is to store it somewhere that's at least controlled off the floor, not necessarily on concrete, but also making sure if you have the capability to hook up a trickle charger to it, make sure you get the appropriate battery tender or trickle charger. And make sure you've got the settings for it, that it gives a good amperage to it to kind of keep that battery healthy through the winter so it's ready to go in the spring when you need it.
Steve in Madison wonders if the negative clamp is needed to go to the battery post, or should he be clamping on bare metal?
Either way, you know, the point of the negative side of things, are we talking about jump starting again in that question?
Yeah, I'm sorry, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a jump starting situation, of course, you have the negative terminal, which is available to you. If you have bare metal, what we're really looking to do is to ground that flow of electricity to get the jump starting going. Now, painted metal under the hood, some people can have some bad luck if they're trying to hook it to a painted component under the hood. They might not have a good connection. Typically, if you have an unfinished metal material, you can find those on like the top of where the shocks are bolted to. The heads of the bolts are a decent place to find that. But yeah, that would work if that's your only option for sure.
All right. Back to the phones and to Jake in Milwaukee, or Jack, I'm sorry. Jack, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Am I on the air? Yeah.
Yeah. What can we do for you?
Oh, well, it's pretty simple. I've got an old Saturn from 1999, and one of the problems I have with it for the last 4 years, every time I get it emission tested, it doesn't fail, it rejects. And I heard stories that if you disconnect the battery, it might reset it. And I've also heard you should go out on a drive cycle, but I understand it's specific to the car and the year. The problem is Saturn's bankrupt, and no one has the drive cycle that's officially from Saturn. Is he aware of this problem?
What do you think, Jim?
Well, you know, it sounds like there's some kind of a code, whether it's permanent or not, I don't know, in there. And, you know, I don't know specifically on a 99 Saturn what you'd have to do to clear it. It is true that a generic method on almost any kind of car, and it's probably true of the Saturn, is that if you disconnect both cables from the battery, touch them together, you know, for a period of time, that it would clear codes. But if it's a permanent code, the computer is still going to set that again. But, you know, ultimately, even though Saturn's not around anymore, lots of people still drive Saturns. Lots of independent shops work on them and have equipment that, you know, you don't necessarily have to have factory equipment to be able to read what codes are in there and get some idea of what the nature of the problem is and why your car is not able to clear that or to be tested.
Okay, so maybe your own garage or your own mechanic can do that work, do you think, then?
Well, they can sure start. There's got to be some kind of a fault code set that what Jack was talking about, disconnecting the batteries is a way to just clear the computer of any non-permanent codes. And, you know, that is a method some people use. It, obviously, if there's a fault in the car, after you drive it for a while, it's going to reset that code. And you know, the problem would be back unless it gets, you know, permanently fixed. But, you know, again, just because Saturn is around doesn't mean there aren't plenty of shops that still work on them.
All right, there you go, Jack. Thank you so much. Bill in Knife River, Minnesota, on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. I have a 2002 Dodge 1500 pickup that I bought in the fall of 2001, and it still has the original battery, and it'll start the truck every morning, 20 years old.
That is fantastic. Yep. How many miles are on it?
About 90,000.
So, and that's pretty low miles for that. That you drive it every day?
Almost.
Yeah. Yep, that is one of those unusual examples, but, yep, that's incredible.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, my goodness me. Mary in Pewaukee called to remind listeners that having too much stuff on your keychain can lead to starting problems. Is that true, Jake?
Yeah, there could be some issues on there, especially going back to the original question about, you know, the Ford Flex from earlier. When you have those communications, the security rings inside the lock cylinder, those the keys and the pins and the communication between the RF or the radio frequency, it could get a little distorted. The other concern you could have is if you have too much weight on your keychain, what can tend to happen is it can get your lock cylinder out of round. And what happens when that happens, if you can imagine pulling too much weight down on one end, it kind of puts things at an angle, and over time, it won't turn true and it won't turn square, and you can have some issues starting your car, definitely.
Thanks again for that call. And we've got open lines for you. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Or go ahead and email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Randy emailed that he has a 2014 Honda Pilot that he has had no issues with at all. How important is it to replace the water pump and the timing belt at 105,000 miles is probably what the recommended thing is. What do you think, Jim?
Well, the timing belt is pretty critical. I mean, it you know, many engines, I have a timing belt that is in an engine that's called an interference engine, and if that belt fails, it's going to do considerable engine damage. Not sure on a 14 Pilot. If that's the case, a lot of modern engines have chains to avoid that entirely. But if you have a timing belt, it is very important to replace it at the manufacturer's suggested interval. And the reason the water pump comes up is on many of those engines, the water pump is driven by the backside of the timing belt, and you have much easier access to it, a much cheaper replacement, often about, you know, 20% of what the normal labor cost might be to get it to that water pump and replace it if it were to fail, you know, at a different time or at a later date. So it's often just a preventative thing to recommend replacing that water pump when a timing belt is being done because of the access that you have to it then.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Casey in Junction City, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I'm working on my tractor. I'm setting the points, and I got a front-end loader on the tractor. So it's very difficult to hand crank the engine over to get dead top center, okay? So okay. I jacked up the rear end thinking, aha, if a fella can pull start a vehicle, why not be able to turn with the wheels just a little bitty so I could get top dead center? That does not work.
Oh, well, that's a new one for the show. I don't remember ever hearing this question before. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I'll tell you, I think I haven't spent a lot of time working on tractors. Jake has spent some time on the farm, so I'm gonna toss that one over to Jake and see what his opinion is on trying to do that.
Good idea. Jake, what do you think?
This is a first one for me, you know, understanding you got the front end loader on this thing. It's a little tough to get around everything. You know, not knowing the exact model of tractor you have, you get your hands on maybe an engine diagram. And what I would see is if you've got any relatable pulleys or cranks that go onto it, you know, on a modern day car engine, we've got a crankshaft and we've got camshafts. And, you know, if we run into that situation where we're trying to get top dead center and we can't get to the crank for any reason, sometimes we'll try to turn the cam just a little bit to get to where we need to get to. I would maybe my best suggestion, see if I could find a diagram for the engine and see what else that crank attaches to. If you have any different types of cams or anything like that in that engine that you can get to an easier access point to maybe give it a little bit of a twist. I was very anxious to see if turning the wheels worked for you. So I was sorry to hear that did not, but yeah, I would see if there's another way for something that's intertwined to the crank, whether it be with a chain or a belt, that you can get a socket on to give a little turn to get you your top dead center to get your points on.
All right. There you go. Good luck, Casey, and thanks so much for calling. Jay in Two Rivers, your turn now. Hi, Jay.
Good morning. I had a 2002 Focus that one time I did something I normally don't do, and I sat without the engine running, and I listened to the radio for about a half hour, and there wasn't enough juice to start the engine. Well, that only happened once, but my 2012 Focus, I think they overcorrected because I get a low battery warning after only playing the radio for about 5 minutes. I've never had trouble starting it, and it does that even with a I replaced the battery once, and the voltage on the battery indicates fine with my meter, but I'm just guessing it's a overly sensitive computer. What do you think?
Jim, what do you think?
One of the things I wonder, when you're listening to the radio, you can have the ignition just on accessory so that most things aren't on. You might have your power jacks powered up at that and the radio, or you can turn the key farther until you have ignition lights on. If you do it that latter way, you're going to be using a lot more power. So if you're listening to the radio and you're able to see the various warning lights and stuff on the dash, turn that key back to the accessory position so that you're not drawing as much power, presuming that you're doing it, you know, with the on the accessory already, you know, that it's I don't think your O2 Focus probably had the warning system that the 12 has to tell you when the battery voltage is getting low. I mean, many cars now have systems where they'll actually shut the accessory right off and tell you that it's a battery warning issue. And the system basically monitoring the battery voltage, and it's not going to let it get too low for you to be in that situation. But those systems aren't perfect, and it may be shutting it off. It's leaving probably a lot of capacity in that battery when it gives you that warning to make sure that it's definitely not going too far. So I doubt that there's really anything wrong there. It's just a new warning system on vehicles and a new system to help keep the battery from discharging too far by, you know, accidentally leaving on accessories on for too long.
All right, Jay, thank you so much for calling. Steve in Reedstown, it's your turn now. Hi, Steve, thank you for calling.
Hi. See, I just had a question about cars that only run on batteries like the Tesla and how they would operate up here in the Northland with the battery with the cold weather, and then how that car would do with the heater running it up here in the cold weather and then with the air conditioning in the summer.
Jim, what do you think?
Yep, definitely big challenges for total electric cars. Cold weather, you know, battery technology has come a long way, and ultimately, it still, though, with everything that they've done, it's still a huge challenge to run an electric car in a cold climate. You know, and obviously, when it's all electric, your heat or air conditioner, either one, is using electric power to function, and so that's going to challenge it even more. You know, there have been a number of documentation of people trying to drive electric cars across the country and take them on long trips and trying to hit the charging systems and, you know, having to plan their routes carefully. You know, someday there'll be enough infrastructure of electrical charging to make that easier, but, you know, it's really a challenge. And it's really interesting to read some of those stories right now about people trying to do that even when it's not cold, just because they have to plan the trip so they are at a certain location and find a charge station and plan to be at that location long enough for it to charge. So, you know, some great technology, but, yep, it certainly is hugely challenged by extreme cold or heat to operate an electric vehicle.
Yeah, there you go, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Well, let's turn to Ron in Madison next. Ron, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. During grade school summers, I rarely drove a neighbor's John Deere Model B, putt, synchronized, where both spark plugs sparked at the same millisecond or microsecond. About 1970, a different neighbor bought a newfangled John Deere tractor where the four cylinders were not synchronized, but its fatal flaw were the two gears that synchronized crankshaft and camshaft. Back then, I knew which one. One was made out of steel, the other was fiber. The fiber one got all its, or some of its teeth chewed off by the steel gear that mated with it, which meant the camshaft stopped moving, turning, while the crank continued. And the pistons came up to top dead center while some of the valves were still wide open, which destroyed the engine. I can't recall if it broke the block and the heads or not, or it was just the pistons and the valves and things like that that were destroyed. But John Deere blew it when they abandoned the synchronized spark plug system.
Yeah. Ron, thanks for calling. Jake, any comment?
Yeah, I mean, it's odd to me, truth be told, to hear of any type of non-steel camshaft is a little alarming. So, you know, based on what you had to say there, it's no surprise to me there were some catastrophic failures based on material use.
Yeah, for sure. Ron, thank you. Appreciate it. Dennis in Prescott, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I got a question about electric cars. I was wondering why you can't run a generator, alternator, something off of the axle or wheels or something that would continually charge the battery so you'd never would have to plug them in.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, regenerative technology is what most hybrids do use, is that the electric motor that is what is running a given wheel or drivetrain, when you hit the brakes, it changes the polarity of that motor and makes it a generator, and then it charges the batteries back up. But there's certain laws of physics that in a conventional vehicle's electrical system, the alternator is being turned by the engine. That uses some energy, but it keeps the battery charged. But that battery is just used to start the engine. To supply enough power to actually run the vehicle and at the same time continually charge it is it depends on that regenerative technology. To have something that's constantly drawing load and constantly charging, at least so far, has not turned out to be as good a technology as having the regenerative braking that is what hybrids currently use.
Ah, all right. Dennis, thanks very much. Here's another Dennis from Two Rivers this time. Hi, thank you for calling.
Another Dennis. Okay, in cold weather, since I've had battery trouble before, I'm just wondering, when I have the rear window defroster on and the fan blowing, since I like to listen to a radio, if I'm listening to a radio at the same time, is that restricting the amount of energy that goes into charging my battery from the alternator?
Jim, what do you think?
Is this the car just sitting with the engine off or with the engine running?
No, while I'm driving.
while you're driving. Well, while you're driving, I mean, initially when you first start a car cold in the morning, the charging system may be a little challenge to run everything that you're trying to run and charge the battery well. If that's one of the reasons that we recommend in cold weather that you not drive the car too short a distance. You want to drive it about, you know, 10, 15 miles, 15 to 20, maybe even better if you're not driving it very far each time that you drive it. So initially, when you first start the car, the alternator is working very hard to charge that battery back up. But as you drive the car for about 10 minutes, 5, 10 minutes, it's pretty well topped that battery up and has plenty of power to run those other things. It really shouldn't be a problem to use all of those devices. But if you're driving really short trips, if in very cold weather, you're starting it up and driving a mile or two or 2 or 3 miles and that's it, you could be withdrawing more than you're depositing in that battery.
Would warming up the car on the driveway make up for not driving it those 15 minutes?
Not typically. That low RPM at idle usually doesn't put enough in there to really make the deposit back that you need to make. It doesn't really make up for what driving it would do.
All right. There you go, Dennis. Thank you so much. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Saul in Stevens Point, on to you now. Hi, Saul.
Hi, good morning. I'm just wondering if car companies, which are rushing headlong into all electric vehicles, aren't also spending time on hybrid, which makes a lot more sense for non-distributed kind of travel. So public transportation, it really makes sense to go all electric if you can do it because they always have their own fuel infrastructure. But for the ordinary guy that goes city, country, or whatever, seems to me that hybrid is still the smarter technology.
Hmm. Well, Jake, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I mean, the investment, there are a couple companies we can talk about. The one we commonly know is Tesla, you know, as far as what they're offering as a consumer, just like myself, I don't know a lot more than you do, but they seem to be very specific on all electric only. But hybrid technology, I think most car manufacturers are still well invested. I know as far as Toyota goes, there's been quite a few reinvestments in new models having hybrids. I know Chevy and Ford have both been doing the same thing. It's interesting to see, though, some of the domestic dealerships, manufacturers going to all electric, like the new Mustang that's coming out. So we'll have to see how that goes. But it kind of ties back into Jim's comment about, you know, the properties and the value of regenerative braking and how that really does hold such a value that I'm not totally convinced it'll be an entirely electric world we live in, but we'll see.
All right, there we go. Saul, thank you for calling. John in Madison, your turn. Hi, John.
I have advice for the farmer who's trying to start his tractor by spinning the rear wheel. I do that all the time with motorcycles. And my advice is to make sure you put it in high gear. It's the reverse situation of trying to drive. It sort of changes the leverage backwards so that, you know, in low gear, your engine gets a lot of leverage on the rear wheel. But in high gear, the rear wheel gets a lot of leverage on the engine. So that's a trick that wasn't mentioned. He might know about it, but that certainly is important.
Yeah, thank you for calling. Jake, a comment?
No, that's a good idea. Yeah, I haven't had to try that myself. I haven't dealt with points in a long time, but that should definitely, high gear, if that does the trick, that'll work for him.
Yeah, that's good. Worth a try for sure. Jake Ward and our Jim Ward, I'm sorry, and Jake Schaefer, our Smart Motors of Madison, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Jim Ward and Jake Schaefer of Smart Motors of Madison, talking about your vehicle on the program today. Questions for these two experts, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Alex in Prairie du Chien, we'll go to you right now. Hi, Alex.
Hey, love the show. I just wanted to talk about a technology a previous gentleman was talking about, hybrids. And there's a technology I don't think has been used since the Chevy Bolt or the Chevy Volt, where the engine is connected solely to a generator. The engine is not connected to the drivetrain at all, and it functions solely to turn a generator to power the batteries or directly power the motors at the wheels, which, and when the engine turns on, it turns at its most efficient RPM. I was wondering what you guys thought about that. Thanks.
All right. Jim, a comment.
It's one of the brilliant technologies out there. I mean, the Toyota Synergy system can do something similar. I mean, it can use the motor just to it can, to the gas engine just to run the motors like generators. You know, it has the ability to do it as regenerative braking as well. And you know, the more flexibility you have in a hybrid system, the more efficient it can be, and the more appropriate it can be under various conditions. But yep, that is a technology that is integrated into you know, many hybrids have the ability to do that and switch out of that for the Bolt and the Volt. That was what they were designed to do exclusively. So, yep, it's just another example of one type of hybrid technology.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Alex. Appreciate it. James and DePere, your turn. Hi, James.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 2015 Ford Explorer, and I think I've changed the headlights on it maybe 5 or 6 times, both of them. I've had the dealer do it. I've done it myself. But they still keep, you know, going out. And now I just found out I have another headlight out again this time, you know, just found out today. So I just was wondering if you guys had any idea what could be causing that.
Jim, what do you think?
Well, do you know what type of headlights they are? Are they a high-intensity discharge or halogen?
James, do you know? Oh, we may have lost him.
Well, there are some type of headlights that will go out more frequently. I mean, it is possible that there is something wrong with the ground or the wiring for the headlight circuits if they're going out real frequently. You know, I guess without more information, I don't know of a common Explorer problem that they go through a lot of headlights, but various manufacturers over time have had issues with their headlight circuits and with some of the new technologies with the high-intensity discharge headlights that may burn out more frequently, and sometimes there are modifications that can be done to help that, and certainly if we've got ground issues that we have a ground circuit that's not grounding well, that's something else that could be repaired that could help with the life of them. But, yeah, we need to have a little more information to understand why that's happening.
All right. Well, Brian in Toma, we will then turn to you. Brian, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi, I have a 2011 Ford Escape Limited, and I've been having dash problems where the electrical plug goes into the dash. It keeps, like, shorting out, and you get, you know, a traction control light, trailer pressure monitor sensor light comes on, door jar light comes on. I don't know if there's any sort of simple fix to that or replace the dash.
Jake, a comment?
So I understand, is the, you know, the cluster, the instrument cluster, is that going dead as well, or just a lot of lights coming on?
Brian, is there, did we lose Brian already?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, go ahead, Brian.
I read online, and when the lights come on like that, if you tap the dash, it would reset it and all the lights would go out. And I have been doing that, and now I realize that the plug on top of the instrument cluster, if you touch on that, sometimes it'll work, and sometimes the dash will just go dead.
Okay. Yeah, you might have a continuity issue in the harness there that comes up to connect. Typically, when you bang on something and all of a sudden things work or don't work, you've got a connection issue. Whether it's in the connector itself or maybe further down the wire before the connector, you might have maybe a rub through on a wire, or you've got something shorting that's causing those issues. I would definitely check on that first. I mean, worst case scenario, you might have an ECU or an ECM or an onboard computer that is maybe malfunctioning to cause all those lights to come on simultaneously. But I would start by checking out the wire and going to the plug to see if that's something that can be a quick, easy fix and just slice a new one in.
There we go, Brian. Thank you for calling. Amanda in Middleton, on to you now. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Hi. I actually wanted to call maybe two or three callers ago. There was a gentleman who was asking about his headlights burning out frequently, and I had that same problem, so I just wanted to offer my opinion.
Sure.
I'm a delivery driver in my own vehicle, and so I'm someone who I turn my car on and off several times a day, more than most people, and so I often used to have many light bulbs burning out. Just because what I have heard in my, you know, unexpert opinion, is that most light bulbs, whether it be in your house or your car, it's the filament itself that burns out whenever you turn it off and on, not the actual running of a light bulb. And so when I switched to LED light bulbs in my car, that helped a lot just with the frequency of burnouts. Because like he was saying, even if you have the dealership do it and they're really careful not to touch the bulb and all that, you still, the more that you turn your lights off and on all the time, it's still just going to burn out. So I found that switching to the LED cell bulbs helped a lot, because I was like him, where I used to get a bulb burning out, you know, every few months. But now that I switched to LEDs, I can go about a year and a half without them burning out. And even when they do, it's usually just a partial, like there's several little LED cells in a bulb. And so maybe one or two of the cells will burn out. So I still have light and it's still safe to be driving. You just have to replace it so you get the full light restored. So maybe he could try that.
Amanda, thank you so much. Jim, a comment.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't sound like a bad idea. LED headlights are something most vehicles can be modified to, and again, you don't have that filament, which is the most common failure in a bulb. LEDs are known to last longer than regular light bulbs, so it doesn't sound like a bad idea. You know, certainly true, too, that many LED designs don't burn out just like a regular conventional bulb where it's black or white. It's either working or it's not. Sometimes the color will change a bit and get to be a lighter pink color, but it's better than having the bulb burn completely out. So that can be fairly expensive to do on some cars, but, you know, if you're having to replace headlights as frequently as it sounds like these individuals have had to, that may be a good option for them.
Yeah, for sure. Amanda, thanks again. Appreciate it. Frank in Duluth, Minnesota, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Frank.
Thank you for taking my call here. I have a 2019 Toyota 4Runner, and I'm noticing a constant battery drain, a low voltage. And I check my batteries quite a bit. I've got an in-dash voltage meter that I installed, and I go out and I check it with a multimeter periodically. And it continually ends up being at about 12.1 to 12.2, even after I run it for a 100-mile trip. It comes back warm. I check it, and it's at 12.56, and then the next day it's down to 12.2, and it seems to get lower. Along with that, when I park it at night, I was camping it at this fall, and when I park it, if the engine's off, the keys are out of the ignition, I'm inside it, so the doors aren't locked, but there's no key in the ignition. There's some motor that starts running periodically during the night in the rear of the vehicle. And I had to jump up and search around to try to find what is running in here. And then we've noticed it now just recently when we parked the car, came back to it, and we heard this motor running inside it. What might that be, and is that draining the battery, and what else is going on?
Jim, what do you think?
Sure. Well, what you're hearing come on at night is an evaporative pump. The evaporative emission system is the system that handles the fuel vapors over the fuel in the gas tank, and those systems do a self-test after the car has been parked 4 to 6 hours. It might vary depending on how the car was last used, but it'll come on. It'll sound, it's an electric pump, so you can certainly hear it in the garage if you happen to go in the garage. And the electrical system and the battery under normal circumstances should be able to handle that just fine. You may have, with the battery concern that you have, a 19 4Runner is subject to a service campaign that has to do with doing some reprogramming for the firmware for the data communication module, and that module may be staying on inappropriately at times, and that may be causing your battery to discharge more than it should. So I would get to a dealer and find out if that campaign isn't what your 4Runner needs to help keep your battery from discharging more than you may want it to. But the sound that you're hearing at night, that's perfectly normal. And when everything else is working right, when if the battery is charged properly, it can handle that testing, and that's never shouldn't be a problem at all in that vehicle.
Frank, thank you very much for calling. Elsie emailed that she has a 2015 Volt with 104 miles per gallon. Is it okay to use antifreeze as in a non-hybrid car? With her Volt vehicle. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I'm not sure what Chevy recommends for antifreeze in that, but I would always use manufacturer's recommended antifreeze. Antifreeze, there are different types of antifreeze out there. I'm not sure what the Volt uses, but the owner's manual is going to have a list of what the manufacturer recommended fluids are for it, and that's what I would use.
Yeah, that makes very good sense. Jim Ward and Jake Schaefer, our guests today with Smart Motors of Madison, both of them, and as you have heard, they know a whole lot about keeping your car running well. And they're going to be with us up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, the weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Jim and Jake. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guests today, vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward and Jake Schaefer from Smart Motors. They're here to answer your vehicle maintenance questions. So what problems are you having with your car? Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And I think we'll just go right back to the phones. Nick in Appleton, it's your turn. Nick, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry, Jim, and Jake. Nice to talk to you. I was calling to comment about the person who talked about hybrid technology would be the way to go for now. And that's probably true. But I just heard about Toyota is coming out with new battery technology. It's called solid-state batteries, and they claim it's going to have much higher energy density per size and weight, and I was going to be able to fully recharge in 10 minutes. So I think that would be a big game changer in the electric car field.
Yeah, I think it would be too. Jim, are you familiar with this?
Well, it is brand new technology that we're not. Toyota's supposed to debut that this year. I don't know about in our country. I think in Tokyo. But battery technology has been one of the thing that has developed the most in automotive technology in the last 10 years, and it will be the thing that develops the most going forward to make changes in vehicles. One of the big factors. What the best thing to do for energy and what market demands and what manufacturers are going to respond to are not always the same thing. For example, right now, fuel is very cheap in this country. Trucks are very popular. Many manufacturers are almost moving out of the car market and moving everything to trucks. That doesn't mean trucks can't be hybrid, but part of where this goes is based on consumer demand rather than just what would really be the most efficient vehicle and the most efficient platform out there. But this specific technology, this is supposed to be a game changer, but all brand new. I really haven't seen it yet and don't have experience with it.
All right. Nick, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Gwen in Oshkosh, turning to you now. Hi, Gwen. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Jim, Jake, and Larry. I bought a 2014 Dodge Caravan 2 years ago. It came with Sirius radio. And so when that expired, we did not renew it. And we found out that our radio AM doesn't come in at all. and that our FM would come on, but it would, I'd get in the car and it would work. I'd go down for maybe 2 miles down the road, it would shut off. Then it would click and come back on. Then it would click and turn back off. And so I thought maybe it had something to do with how much juice Sirius Radio took out of their radio. So I told Mike to hook it back up. So we did. And it does the same thing. And sometimes you can see the radio on the dashboard, and it doesn't come on at all. You can see that it's on, and then it'll click on. But as soon as you shut the door, get back in from the grocery store, it won't come back on again. You got to wait. So I'm wondering if I have a short, if I need more juice that Sirius Radio took. And I did call the dealership, and I asked them about fixing my radio, and they said it would be, the start of it is $800 because of labor.
Jim, what do you think?
Well, here's how I weigh it. You know, radios used to be a simple device before satellite radio, before Bluetooth and everything, and we didn't see many problems with them. And when we did, it generally was a replacement of a radio. Most of the radio problems we see anymore are software problems. They're actually computers, and in most cases, there are software downloads that end up correcting it. So those are specific. That's not to say every radio out there is going to have a software download to fix its given issue, but the radio is rebooting like a computer rebooting, and the things you're describing are typically repaired with a software update, and it typically is not anything like $800. So I guess I would call around and inquire a little bit more at someplace else. I mean, a starting point really should be much less expensive, you know, than that. I mean, ultimately, if you have to replace a radio, it could very well get into that range. But if someone's just giving you that information over the phone, there's not enough known here yet to know that you're going to have to spend that kind of money. I would find somebody that's willing to look at it for somewhat, you know, a great deal less than that, or just actually have your VIN number ready and have, a Chrysler dealer check. Well, I don't know if that's possible to check and find out if there has been a bulletin, if there's been a software update for that.
That makes a lot of sense. Good luck, Gwen. Thank you so much. Let's go to Peter in Wausau next. Hi, Peter.
Great. Hi. I am trying to diagnose a squeak in my steering wheel. I took my car in this fall to get a new set of snow tires, put on a separate set of rims, and when I got the car back, there was like a mosquito buzzy type sound coming from the wheel, maybe with a little bit of vibration too, but it was very faint. And it's not when I'm turning the wheel necessarily, it's right around 30 miles an hour and above.
So it starts squeaking when you turn it at around 30 miles an hour, right?
But I don't need to be turning the wheel.
Okay. Jake, what do you think?
Yeah, well, if it was a rotational noise, like when you're turning the wheel, I'd definitely take a look at the intermediate shaft that connects the steering wheel down to your power steering rack. But, you know, a squeak coming just from the steering wheel area at that range, it could be a number of things. I would maybe see if the behind your steering wheel there's a little plastic cowl between your steering wheel and your instrument cluster, if maybe something's rubbing or touching in there that you just got a little lack of tolerance and you're hearing it, being that it's near the, just coming from the steering wheel, driving straight at 35 miles an hour, it could be a number of things. I don't want to ultimately say it's due to the tires, but I would start by just checking out the steering wheel, see how it looks with that plastic cover that sits behind it, see if there is any rubbing or anything like that that's causing some noise for you. It might be an easy, quick fix. If not that, you'll have to kind of start eliminating some things, to kind of isolate that noise the best your ability, see if you can figure that one out.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Jim?
Well, you know, I guess, Peter, if you're still there, is this noise definitely sounds to you like it's coming from the steering wheel or steering column?
Is it coming from? We might have. Well, I guess we lost him.
Yeah, I mean, if it's definitely coming from there, often after tires and wheels are replaced, you might have had a backing plate on the brake assembly tweaked a little bit that could be touching, and noises in vehicles are often sound like they're coming from somewhere other than they are. But, you know, if it definitely sounds like it's coming from the steering column, yeah, Jake's giving you the best tips on addressing that. If you're not sure where it's coming from, you might want to try some other experiments to try to narrow down the source and where it's really coming from.
All right. There you go, Peter. Thank you. Let's turn to Sam in Verona. Sam, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I am having an issue where one of my friends told me that my headlight was out. One of my headlights was out. And so I opened up the hood and unhooked the light itself from, like, the lens that it's in, and then the light turned on. I was like, oh, okay. And then so I plugged it. I would try to plug it back in, and then it turned off, unhooked it again, it turned back on, and I plugged it back in, and now it's on. So I'm wondering if I need to worry about maybe it's an electrical issue, or should I prepare to go buy a new bulb? What do you think?
What do you think, Jim?
In most cases, that's going to be a bulb. Automotive bulbs don't tend to just burn out and quit working entirely. They'll be out. A bump can make them come back on. Doing the old Fonzarelli bump with your fist on the front of the headlight lens or anywhere on the headlight assembly may make it come back on. I mean, you could have a connection problem somewhere else, but this is very typical of how automotive bulbs, headlight bulbs, behave when they're starting to fail.
All right, there you go. Thank you, Sam, for calling. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Rich in Madison, your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hello. I've got a comment / question. It seems that a lot of the dealerships now, the mechanics do not actually work for the dealer. They are independent contractors, and they seem to get a percentage of whatever work they can recommend, so there's a tremendous amount of upselling. I've had that happen to me a couple of times where thousands of dollars of repairs were suggested, which I knew were not needed because a professional mechanic had already checked the car out before I took it in. What's the comment or what's your take on that?
Jim, comment on that.
Well, technicians typically have there's all kinds of different pay plans out there for technicians. They typically, in most dealerships, they're going to be employees of the dealership. They're not independent contractors. The way that they're often paid is by piecework. But the thing is, you know, integrity is something that ultimately pay plans can affect, but one has integrity or they don't. And ultimately, you know, over-recommending work, recommending too much work, you know, with any kind of pay plan that a technician can have can be something that someone would do. You know, really, any shop that you're working with, you want to have a relationship with the people that you work with so that, you know, you've got a consultant kind of relationship with them, and ultimately you're going to know the difference between someone that's just trying to sell you and someone who is trying to work on a relationship and have more of a long-term, meaningful exchange with a customer. But certainly, you know, they're just like any field out there. There are people out there that don't have great conscience and will try to rip people off. I don't think it matters what field we're talking about, but that can be true of mechanics. You know, the better shops are going to weed those people out.
Yeah. Thank you, Rich, for calling. Appreciate it. Deb in Brown Deer, your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hi. My son has a 2000 Toyota Corolla, and he's obsessed with putting parts on it, and usually they're aftermarket, so that's one of my queries. Do you think that's not a good thing? He should be using quality parts, and now he's doing the bearings. Should he do all four tires? Because I'm thinking he's just focusing on the right front, the passenger side.
Jake, what do you think?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, whenever possible, you want to use manufacturer recommended parts. There are a true of parts out there that are OEM compliant or certified parts that you can use in the aftermarket world. Definitely, you know, sometimes the cheapest part is not going to be the best option. So if you do choose aftermarket, you want to make sure you have something reputable, something that typically comes with a warranty as well. In regards to the bearing question, you know, if we're replacing the bearing because it's worn out or it's making noise, you know, you have a couple options. One, you replace it when it's failing or making noise. Or the other side of that is, you know, as you had asked, Deb, maybe we replace, you know, both of them in the front or all four of them because they are the same age. They all, if one's wearing out, there's a possibility the rest of them can wear out. It's really up to you how you want to handle that. But, yeah, I mean, at any time we want to try to use manufacturer parts or choose a good alternative in the aftermarket, so that's the way we go.
Yeah. Okay. There you go, Deb. Thank you. Mac in Appleton, your turn now. Hi, Mac.
Hey. Yeah, I was just driving my, I have a 2003 Odyssey. It has like 300,000 miles on it. But last night I noticed it, and then just now I was driving and my light for my battery came on and all the door sensors came on. Last night it went off, but now it's just constantly on. It's not like it's, I don't lose power or lose anything, but just my battery indicator and my doors, they're all flashing on.
Hmm.
I was just wondering if it's electrical, you know, or what do you think?
Or what's going on? Yeah, Jim, what do you think?
Well, and beyond the battery light, what are the other lights that are switching on? You're the indicating doors are ajar, or what light are you seeing beyond the battery light?
The red light could be on. That's only two indications.
Okay. Well, you know, most typically when a battery light's on, it's indicating a problem with the charging system, with the alternator. You know, and it doesn't necessarily mean the alternator's failed, but there's a fairly easy test to do to see if it's putting out enough. And again, like many things electronic and automobiles, they don't tend to just fail all at once when the electronic problems tend to be intermittent and may work a little bit and then not work and work a bit and not work. So the fact that you had a light on and out went off isn't too uncommon with an electrical problem. But I would have that alternator output checked out. It's a fairly simple and inexpensive test to determine whether it's starting to go. It may be just putting out just enough to keep the light off, but would be obviously testing lower than it should be, you know, on that test if that's what the problem is. And it could be a ground problem somewhere in the vehicle as well, that you're getting different circuits that are giving you warnings like that.
All right, there you go. Thank you, Deb. Appreciate it. Kurt in Heartland has a 2014 Kia Optima, and when he starts the car for the first time each day, he has to jiggle the shifter knob back and forth to just the right spot, and then it starts. Multiple starts later in the day don't require that maneuver. What do you think's the issue there? Jim, what do you think?
Similar to what we were talking about earlier, Jake was referring to a neutral safety switch that is a device that only allows the car to start and park in neutral. And ultimately, if it's a little out of adjustment or has some dirty contacts, you may have to wiggle it a bit to get that in the right position for it to start. You know, ultimately, once you've moved it, maybe that's made a good connection, is going to work for the rest of the day. But, you know, the ideal situation is going to be someone testing it while it's acting up, trying to determine if we've got the right signals where they need to go to get a signal from the neutral safety switch, telling the ignition that it's okay to start the car.
A listener emailed, he has a low rumble somewhere under the car since getting new tires and rear brakes. It's constant and associated with RPMs, but not loud enough for the service tech to actually hear it. Jake, what do you think?
Yeah, a low rumble under the car. You know, sometimes there's some association. You know, if the individual emailing in is also feeling a shake maybe in their seat and it's a four-wheel drive, we might have, you know, some issue with the drivetrain and the drive shaft. A low rumble could be an indicator of some uneven tire wear that can certainly cause some noise as well. So, you know, if they are getting new tires, I would get the new tires done. I'd maybe have the shop take a look at the rest of the tires and see how the wear is, and then maybe see if they notice it after the tires. You know, if we've replaced the tires, we've aligned it, and we've done everything we should, and we still encounter it, maybe we've got to look a little deeper at, like, a drive line or maybe a wheel bearing or something along those lines.
And let's see, we've got another email. Laura in Menominee Falls has a 2007 Toyota RAV4. She emailed to ask what the best way is to repair dull headlamps. The plastic is no longer clear, maybe?
Right, that's what she's talking about. That's a type of plastic that the sun causes to heat up pretty badly. Well, there are different kits that are made. You can buff those headlights off to clear that haze off of them. That is something that can return. There's different methods and different kits. You can buy a do-it-yourself that you just sort of hand rub on, or you can have it done by a shop that uses a buffer. The latter method is going to last longer. It's going to take more of that material off. Either way will look better, even if you do it with a hand method. But there are ways to improve and minimize that haze and have the headlights be useful for a number of years yet when that happens. But it will likely return, and each time it returns, it's a little more difficult to get rid of and have it last longer. But it's certainly something that can be addressed with the right type of compound and buffing.
And Robert in McFarland emailed to ask, what are the best practices for overwintering a car? I assume, maybe Robert takes off for somewhere else and leaves the car over winter. What do you need to do? Jake, any ideas on that?
Yeah, talking about, starting the conversation with batteries as we did, not a bad idea to get a battery tender or trickle charger on that battery to keep some charge in it, to keep it healthy over the wintertime. You want to make sure your fuel, depending on how long you're gone, a good rule of thumb is keep your fuel tank at least a half tank or more to try to avoid any type of freezing or anything like that. The other thing we don't think about outside of just what the vehicle can do is maintaining it against any invaders like mice and rodents and things like that. So set yourself up with some, pest deterrent and stuff like that, because that can really wreak havoc on things if they get in there and get at your wiring and things of that nature.
Good advice. Well, here we are approaching the end of the show. And, Jim, I just want to say I've had so much fun with you over the past years talking with folks about vehicles. You've done such a great job for us. And I know our listeners would join me in thanking you so much for all you've done for us over the years. It's been a real pleasure. And we certainly want to wish you and your wife the best in your retirement. Thank you so much for all of your work and efforts over the years. It's been a real pleasure working with you.
Well, thank you so much, Larry. I'm humbled and honored, to be on the show. I've listened to you for years, and the WPR community is just a unique and special community, as everybody out there listening knows, So thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. It has been my pleasure and honor to be a part of it.
Well, best of luck to you. And Jake Schaefer, it's been great having you with us on the show. I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Of course, I appreciate you having me. Thank you. And of course, always thank you to Jim. It'll be a little different without you. And thank you to all the callers and everything for your great questions.
Yeah, it's been really great. Several years Jim's been doing this program, and I wish him well in retirement, that's for sure. And for you as a listener, I want to thank you again for being with us on the Ideas Network. We feel really fortunate to have you listening in on the show. And I want to acknowledge again that it's been a hard 24 hours for me and for you and for the whole country. WPR is following the news closely. We'll keep you informed. Informed so you're sure to, I hope you'll stay with us on the air, online for continued coverage of the news today. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening again here on the Ideas Network.